866-336-3605.
I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. It's said that when Detroit sneezes, America catches a cold. Well, both Motor City and the U.S. economy are under the weather, but who's catching whose colds is the question. Despite the stalling economy, last year was the second best year ever in new car sales. But those surging sales still can't get the U.S. auto industry into gear. This time last year, Chrysler announced thousands of layoffs, and last Friday, Ford cut 22,000 jobs in North America. The boss, William Clay Ford Jr., thinks his company took its eyes off the prize.
The great success that we enjoyed may have caused us to underestimate the growing strength of our competitors. Our success may have also caused us to underestimate the effect of the economic downturn. We also had some well-publicized issues that diverted our resources and, I think, more importantly, our attention. We also pursued strategies that were either poorly conceived or poorly timed. We strayed from what got us to the top of the mountain, and it cost us greatly.
It cost Ford to the tune of $5 billion in 2001. Connection listeners, the joyride of the 1990s has come to an end. It's time to assess the damage. Will the U.S. auto industry once again reinvent itself? Or is it slowly losing the race to the engineers of the imports? And what about you? Do you identify with Detroit's plight? And does Made in America still motivate you in the showroom? Join our conversation. We're at 1-800-423-TALK. That's 1-800-423-8255. You can, of course, join us online at theconnection.org. I'm joined from the studios of Michigan Public Radio by Chubb Achetta. He's the editor-in-chief of Car and Driver magazine. And on the line from the GM offices in Detroit by John Middlebrook, who's vice president and general manager of vehicle brand marketing and corporate advertising. Welcome to both of you.
Good morning.
Hey, good morning.
Chubb, I'm going to start with you. There's been a lot of talk about Ford over the past week, but step back one. The American car makers in general, they share a number of collective concerns, don't they?
Well, they do. This has always been a cyclical business in the United States, and we had thought perhaps in the 90s that the industry could restructure itself in such a way that it would get out of the major ups and downs of the cycle. But it looks like what we're seeing now is the end of the positive cycle of the 90s and the U.S. car makers hurting for profits again. And it's the usual boom or bust business that we've seen time and again in this business.
John Middlebrook, you've got 42 years in with General Motors, Oldsmobile, Pontiac, Chevrolet, Saturn. I'm wondering how you view this in the cyclical terms that Chubb is talking about.
Well, there's no question. I think we go through these cycles. We're pretty, pumped up at GM because we were coming off a good year in 2001. We did increase our market share, and of course, we are profitable. But the pressure in the industry is huge. There is overcapacity, and certainly in the long term, just the race always comes down to product and brand and value to the customer.
What about the speculation, Mr. Middlebrook, that this lower end of the cycle may not let you back up again, that the Koreans are pushing so hard, that the Japanese have got such a slice of the market share, that there won't be that swing back up for American car makers?
Well, there's certainly that's one school of thought, and the non-big three, if you will, the foreign car makers did increase again their share of the industry in 2001. And no question, the Koreans are taking a pretty big bite out of the low end of the market right now. But again, at General Motors, we were able to increase share first time in 10 years in 2001, and in the face of that, so I think the value of good product and strong, you know, marketing programs will still win the day.
And Chubba, the type of return that Mr. Middlebrook's talking about, do you see that coming, you know, as early as later in this year or a number of years from now? How do you view it?
Well, it's hard to say. Certainly, Ford is not going to come back to its former strength within 12 months. and neither is Chrysler for that matter. I think we're looking at returns to profitability, certainly a couple of years out. We've got to keep in mind in this, as John points out, that while we talk about the U.S. industry, it really isn't a monolith, because right now GM is not in nearly as bad shape as Ford and Chrysler is. GM is profitable this year, and if we go back 5 or 6 years or go back through the 90s, Ford had a very good decade in the 90s because they really tapped into the truck cycle. Chrysler had a pretty good decade of the 90s, and GM actually didn't back then, in part because it had not come up with the truck products that the market was moving towards. GM has redressed that issue now, and that's one of the reasons they're in reasonable shape. And it's also one of the reasons why Ford and Chrysler are having more trouble, because they don't have that clear sailing in the truck segments that they did a few years ago.
Sean McAlinden is director of the Economics and Business Group at the Center for Automotive Research in Ann Arbor. He's joining us on the phone. Sean, your most recent study, or one of your recent study, involved the economic contribution of the auto industry to the U.S. economy. Will we ever again be able to say unequivocally that when Detroit sneezes, America catches a cold? Is it still that important?
Well, without question, you know, over time, about 40% of the variation in gross domestic product is usually due to changes in automotive production and sales. That was true throughout the 90s. In fact, that little-known fact was that our share of gross domestic product isn't as what it used to be 20 years ago, but growth in the industry outpaced the economy between 1987 and the year 2000. So anytime your real growth of an industry is higher than the overall economy, you're contributing to growth. So are we as significant as we were 20, 30 years ago? No. Are we still 5% of all private sector jobs, 3.5% to 4% of gross domestic product? Without question, more than any other manufacturing industry. So, you know, a major downturn, which we haven't seen quite yet in the industry, is always a heavy blow to the economy. And we did, just a year or two ago, re-achieve and break employment and production peaks that were set in the late 70s. So this is still a growth industry, despite, you know, common perception. So very, very important, the economic health of the industry.
And in your research, Sean, do you still see that sense of attachment that Americans have to the car industry as an example of the power of the economy? Do people still give it that same extra edge because of the way they understand it?
Well, I'm not sure they do. I obviously, we're very loyal in certain states like Michigan, Ohio. You know, it's the magazine editor probably knows more marketing, has a better marketing perspective than we do. We don't, you know, cars and trucks are so expensive, although obviously a relative bargain compared to income, compared to last past years, but still there's such a high price in the consumer's budget that it's difficult to, you know, attach a lot of loyalty or patriotism to that, you know, to that kind of purchase. Although the market does split out sometimes between those who really do care and prefer domestic, and almost a separate market up until now for international products. Like car and drivers speak to that.
Yeah, Chava, how are you seeing that? I mean, we don't read news stories about people scratching the paint off Nissans or smashing Hondas these days.
Well, it seems to be less of an issue these days than it was in the early 80s when certainly the Japanese car makers were first starting to make inroads. But that's another point that's worth mentioning. You know, we were talking about the domestic industry, but even among the Japanese, they build somewhere between two-thirds and three-quarters of all their cars in the United States these days. They do a lot of engineering here. Even some of the European companies like Mercedes and BMW have manufacturing plants in the United States. So trying to determine whether those vehicles are domestic or import is not so easy anymore, and I think the public understands that on a certain level. After all, you know, Honda's been building Accords outside of Columbus, Ohio for 20 years now.
Except, John Middlebrook, you're still able to make some marketing weight with the public by, you know, saying keep America rolling, buy a GM product. Is that touching that type of patriotism, that attachment that Americans have to Motor City?
Well, there is some latent I would say support for domestic brands from that, particularly maybe when the country rallies and patriotism shows. But frankly, it's been dissolving on both ends. I mean, there certainly, as we measure this very carefully all the time, there's fewer domestic only buyers, and there's fewer, frankly, foreign only buyers. There used to be a lot of people that decided that, hey, the only way to get good quality was to buy an imported or a foreign nameplate. And of course, now that we've pretty well leveled up the playing field on quality, that's gone away. So I think what we're seeing now is best value to the consumer, wins in the marketplace. And the car is still it's an emotional purchase, and you have to build the brand value and the value of that brand will ultimately determine, where you get your customer.
Chobachetta, there are studies here. Help me with this. Are the American cars acknowledged to be as well built as the imports?
I don't think so. Not quite yet, but the gap is vastly smaller than it used to be. I think in almost all the quality studies, you still see Toyota and Honda and their various luxury brands near the top of the heap, with some of the domestics right behind them. And currently, I think GM is the quality leader among the domestics. Ford has slipped to, I think, number 7 among the major car makers, and that's one of their issues. But the gaps in general are a lot smaller than they used to be.
Sean McElinden, one of the things that gave the American automakers that big jump through the 1990s was the fact that they owned the minivan, they owned the SUV market at a time when people wanted to pay for that. But now with the import manufacturers getting well into those markets, is that a big danger sign for you as far as the future of the American car makers?
It's probably the biggest threat we have in the remainder of the decade, or at least the next 5 years. We call it the big squeeze. Essentially, the Koreans have now about 6% of the passenger car market and maybe over half the small, low-priced car market. The Europeans are now at record share on the cars that cost over $35,000. And now the Japanese have not only reestablished themselves in the light truck market at their previous high of 20% in 1986, they've exceeded it with just a host of, just an ocean wave of new sport utilities, full-size pickups, minivans, stretch out to the horizon. The Japanese did not fare well in the market in the 1990s, and the media gave it very little attention. They lost 4 market share points. 7 of their 9 companies lost their independence because they didn't do that well in this U.S. truck boom. But what Detroit obviously should have saw coming, and I think some did, was that the Japanese would particularly Honda and Toyota, not take this laying down. If that's what sells in America, they're going to build it. And they're actually going to build much of it here. And someone's going to lose in the next 2 years in terms of that incredibly profitable truck share. And, just the very fact that Toyota has a full-size pickup is almost mind-boggling. And that Nissan may have one within a year, and Honda's considering one. These are trucks that they would sell nowhere else in the world, except in the U.S. and to a certain extent in Canada. And they don't like losing. And now we're in trouble, and we have to find a new game plan, no question about it.
Connection listeners, someone is going to lose in the big squeeze that the U.S. auto industry is facing. Now, who's going to lose? And if you as a purchaser have something to say about it, what is that? Our number's 1-800-423-8255 to join the conversation. You're listening to The Connection on NPR.
From Boston University, this is WBUR, Boston's NPR news station.
Listening to The Connection on National Public Radio. We're talking about cars. My guests include John Middlebrook, GM Vice President, General Manager of Vehicle Brand Marketing and Corporate Advertising. Chobachetta is Editor-in-Chief of Car and Driver Magazine. Sean McElinden is Director of the Economics and Business Group at the Center for Automotive Research in Ann Arbor. Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. We're going to Acton, Massachusetts. Michael's on the line. Hello, Michael.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call.
Yeah, thanks for calling.
I wanted to comment on the what I believe is a contributor to the cyclical nature of the American auto industry, and I think it really goes far wider than the auto industry, which is the American, I believe, the American manufacturing and innovation, or American, you know, industry is really, the economy is really focused on innovation. Americans have always been the ones who have invented stuff. But the Japanese, a lot of the, you know, a lot of the Europeans as well, but primarily the Japanese, are extremely, extremely adept, and I think it's culturally ingrained, to refine and polish and make a more desirable product from a an existing base. So I wanted to comment and hear what you had to say on the thought that, or the proposition that we're going to continue to see this type of cycle where America will innovate, such as with the, you know, the SUV or the minivan, or, and I work in technology, so I've seen this a lot in the 70s with the consumer electronics and such, and will innovate and, you know, gain a huge amount of market share and an economic boom as a result of that.
But you're saying once the innovation is done, then the Japanese and the Koreans are simply better at manufacturing, at turning it out at a high quality? Is that the point you're making?
That's the point I'm making. And then when pressed, we innovate again.
Let's give that to Sean McElinden.
Well, that's been noted before. GM's one of the most innovative firms of the last century. They basically developed a catalytic converter in the mid-70s. There might not be an auto industry. You know, the minivan, the sport utility, even front-wheel drive and mass production are actually Detroit innovations. But when it comes to essentially turning that innovation into something that pleases the consumer and realizes market gain, it's sort of the improvement every day and every year, operating sort of like an Intel, so to speak.
Let me turn
to
John.
Japanese are better.
Let me turn to John Middlebrook here. Then, I mean, if that is the case, why is it then difficult for the American innovations to remain at the top of the cycle? Why is it that this cycle works the way Michael's suggesting it does?
Well, I would agree. I think the innovations, for the most part, still do come from the domestic side, and that may be part of our nature and makeup as Americans. But certainly, as execution and comes down to processes, and the Japanese particularly are very good at that. But I think that we'll continue to see that cycle of innovation, and you can point to lots of examples here at the recent auto show.
But what Michael's saying about the cycle is that the Americans can't maintain the manufacturing edge once the innovation is done. Isn't that the way to break the cycle?
Well, certainly it is, and I think as we're starting to put, and we talked about this playing field getting leveled now on the quality side, and that's all about manufacturing execution. We've just opened up a new assembly plant in Lansing, Michigan for the Cadillac CTS that I think puts raises the bar on all auto manufacturers for the kind of product it's going to put out. But we'll see how that works out. We've been in a joint venture with Toyota out in NUMMI in California for a lot of years now to learn the Toyota production system. And I think we understand how to execute the product now just as Toyota does.
Chubba, I want to get your point of view on this. You've been writing about this industry for a long, long time, and I wonder if we're not just sliding back into the sort of classic cultural prejudice of the Japanese can churn them out faster than the Americans. And I mean, certainly there is a lot of innovation that comes from the Japanese car makers. What do you think?
Well, in some of these major categories, I think it's quite correct that the American car makers have invented them. The minivan is certainly one. The SUV is another. And these have been very, very strong and profitable segments in the last 20 years. I think inherently, though, keep in mind in this business, there's no patent protection. There's no trademark protection. So one manufacturer can innovate. They gain a temporary lead because they're out there first. And pretty soon the others jump in. There's no way way to sustain those initial advantages indefinitely. They're always going to dissipate to some extent. Now, how far they dissipate depends on some of these other factors. It still seems that the Japanese car makers have advantages in the quality of their vehicles and also seem to have some cost advantages. They seem to be able to manufacture vehicles with a certain level of equipment for less money than the domestics, and that allows them to price very attractively. There's one other thing going on here, too. It seems that traditionally some of the Japanese manufacturers, at least the strong ones like Honda and Toyota, do not overbuild their factories. They are willing to lose some business because of insufficient production, and they won't build a new factory until they're certain they can sell its entire output. The domestics have a tendency to increase production when times are good to make sure they don't lose any sales, and consequently, when sales pull back a little bit, then immediately they have to start cutting capacity. So it's definitely more of a zigzag up and down business model.
And didn't Honda just open a new plant in Alabama a couple of months ago?
Well, they're just opening that now in order to add on to their SUV capacity. Honda, at this point, at the auto show, just announced a new mid-sized SUV called the Pilot. What this is it's based on the Acura MDX, which is a luxury SUV they've been building for about a year now, and that, in turn, is based on the Honda Odyssey minivan. The Odyssey minivan has been in short supply ever since it was introduced a year and a half, 2 years ago. There's still waiting lists for it. Same thing for the MDX. So now they're going to build a new plant to alleviate those waiting lists and introduce a new product. But they've waited. They lost several sales, probably tens of thousands of sales over the last 2 years because they didn't have the extra plant capacity, right. But they would rather lose those sales than overbuild their factories.
Michael, thank you for your call to Lexington, Massachusetts. Connie, you're on The Connection. Hi.
Thanks so much for taking my call.
Yeah.
I just wanted to relate a story of why it is that I would not be buying a domestic car anytime soon, and that is that I had a Chrysler minivan, and the brakes failed on me 3 times within about a month, the last time really jeopardizing my life and my children's life. I was told when I called, because I immediately got on the phone about this and called corporate headquarters, that there had been a run of faulty pumps for the anti-lock brake system. Now, and this was actually an item that had been on recall, but they continued to use these faulty pumps. They wouldn't do anything about my situation or
a couple of quick questions, Connie. Did your dealer not want to help you out on this?
My dealer passed me right off to Detroit. They claimed they had people come down to kind of inspect the whole, van and whatnot. And
is the fault with Chrysler product mean that the Ford and the Chevy is also then faulty?
Well, the problem is, I think, is that then I started asking around independent mechanics, and people, actually towers. I decided I was going to get to the heart of this problem and see, what was going to be best for me and my family. And between asking the mechanics and actually the people who tow wrecked cars, one of whom told me that they would never even consider a van, which, of course, as you pointed out, is part of what's fueling the American market because of their ability to smash and collapse.
Let's get John Middlebrook from General Motors to talk to the point that Connie's making. John?
Well, first of all, I'm glad it was a Chrysler product and not a GM that you had a problem with. But, J.D. Powers does all these quality measurements, and as you add them up, the playing field is pretty level now across foreign and domestics. If you look at recalls and the average number of recalls, they don't vary much between the domestics and the imports. So when a problem like apparently you had here happens, obviously the manufacturer does have to step up and take care of the customer, or you lose that customer, and it sounds like you're an example of that. But certainly from a concern about buying a minivan, if that's what you want to buy, between domestic or import, the products are very safe now, and they have a lot of safety ratings you can compare to help your purchase.
Though there was that move in the 1980s when the boomer generation started to buy its cars, and the boomers started to move into imports in a big way. And I guess what I hear in part in Connie's tone, John, is that same sense of the swing away from the American car and the sense that the import car is going to offer better quality.
Yeah, and that was true in the 80s. And, you know, perception and reality always lag in any business, but particularly in the car business. So we had a time through the 80s where the perception of the American quality being as good or higher was there, and it wasn't true. And now that we really have leveled that playing field back up and the quality is as good, at least certainly on the GM products, we rate just behind Toyota and Honda. In fact, it's a good chance we could even go by Honda this year when the next J.D. Powers comes out. But again, that perception is there, and we have to overcome it with great product.
What would it take for you, Connie, to buy an American-made car?
I'd have to have my mechanics that I talk to, and I know a number of people that are in that field, which gives me an advantage. I'd have to have them come to me and say, this gentleman can say all that he'd like to. Oh, yes, we've leveled the playing field. I don't believe that's true. It's going to take a lot to change my mind.
Connie, I want to move along. I want to thank you for your call.
Thank you.
Okay, 1-800-423-8255. And we're talking about the state of the American car industry, the threats from foreign manufacturers. We'd like to know your thoughts on that. We're going to John calling us from Boston. Hi, John.
Hello.
Hi, John. Go ahead.
Yes, I wanted to speak a bit about a specific defect that basically all cars, American and well, what we would call foreign still, seem to exhibit, and that is monstrous overweight. Basically, if the cars weighed 1,000 pounds less, you could use a smaller engine and obtain better power to weight, better fuel economy, and better handling.
Isn't part of the argument, though, John, that if you could build a car all out of plastic and cut the weight right down, you wouldn't have as safe an automobile?
Well, why would you do that? No, a space-based frame, essentially some of the things that they do in race cars now. Formula One cars, for instance, essentially are made out of plastic, and they're the safest cars in the world. You drive a Formula One car into the wall at 150 miles an hour, you probably survive.
The problem with this argument is that the technologies needed to build cars lighter are extremely expensive. GM did a concept car a few years ago that weighed about 2,000 pounds, and I believe the carbon fiber alone in the body was $30,000 in cost, not to mention the assembly price of it. There's a lot of things that can be done. There's a couple of cars on the market that are built out of aluminum, but for the most part, they're very expensive cars or they're sold at a loss. And the public in general has not clamored for lighter weight automobiles, especially in this current climate where gas is cheap.
But if the changes were made, and this would hold true for the fuel cells as well, if Detroit decided, hey, we're going to mass manufacture cars made out of lighter material or engines that are more efficient, then wouldn't some of those, Sean McAlin, wouldn't some of those costs come down?
Well, yeah, that's the whole game, is mass production is completely different than these knockoff 1 or 500 cars. And you know, you'll often see cars with plastic bodies because they're a niche vehicle, and that's the cheapest way to make those with plastic. Once you see the steel or aluminum on the outside, they're mass production. We're currently carrying out some long-run studies for the state of Michigan on what manufacturing fuel cell vehicles might look like, because really no one in the industry to date has considered what kind of industry would that call for, what kind of scale economies were needed. And we don't think they're going to be terribly different, from today's the volumes. That's one thing that really hasn't changed much in the auto industry, is you sort of break even on a vehicle at 200,000 to 300,000 units, about the level you need to pay for a new engine or special engine. And, we have to solve these questions, not only obviously for these new alternative powertrain vehicles of the future. We have to also think about the infrastructure behind them, which was talked about at the auto show. Where are we going to get the hydrogen or the fuel to power them? So so on and so forth.
Let me hear from John Middlebrook on this, John, because you were saying a little bit earlier perception lags reality, and we get off into a conversation about lighter materials and fuel cells as if this was something that was in demand. People, or your perception of what people want, is that people still want big engines, big trucks, fast trucks, all that, which runs completely counter to the other argument.
Well, that's right. I mean, first of all, we're in business to supply customers what they want. If people really were willing to pay a significant premium for a lighter weight, higher fuel efficient product, then we'd be providing them. We know how to build them, but just as Sean said, to get to the lighter weight costs money. Your phone-in said talked about a Formula One car. Well, they cost around $25 million each. So, yeah, they're pretty safe. But there's quite a trade-off between the mass weight and the cost of a vehicle.
John from Boston, you're on a car phone, are you?
Yes, I am.
What are you driving?
I'm actually pulled over now in the North End. I basically wanted to say that I think that this is not quite the direction that my comments were trying to go. I think that a car that costs $60,000 or $70,000, basically ought to be small, light, and powerful. I'm talking about maybe a 250 horsepower engine and a 1,300 pound car.
What are you driving now, John?
Well, I'm in a Civic.
And that's too heavy for you?
Oh, yeah. Way too heavy. I mean, it's possible you can actually make it go around corners. But, you know, for an engine this size, it certainly ought to weigh 1,000 pounds less.
John, thanks for your call.
You're welcome.
1-800-423-8255. And we'll go to Rockport, Massachusetts. Elizabeth, you're next. Hi.
Hi. Morning.
Yes, go ahead, Elizabeth.
Yeah, I'm an antique dealer. I'm driving a 1992 Ford Econoline 150 with a six-cylinder engine. I bought it used from a dealer in 1994. It was owned previously by the maintenance people at Digital Corporation, and it was maintained down in Maryland, so I was very happy to get it because it was not a salted road. And I've had it since 1994, and it's now 2002. I have 199,000 miles on it. And I met somebody who's a consultant for industry, and I don't want to mention his name.
What's your point here, Elizabeth, that the older cars are better?
The consultant told me I have a really good, well-built engine. They built them really good by Ford in 1992 to 1995. He said, don't sell it as long as it keeps going. You have a strong motor, and you might get another 100,000 miles out of it. And I get cards from somebody who sells used vans from 1992 to 1995 in South America and Europe. He wants my van because he sends it overseas because they're strong vans and people will buy them at second hand.
Elizabeth, we've got to step away for a short break, but we're going to pick up that point that you've raised about whether or not the older vehicles were the better vehicles, or whether or not that's sort of the nostalgia for what we once used to drive. Our number is 1-800-423-8255. You're listening to The Connection on National Public Radio.
From Boston University, this is WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. Coming up at 11.
You're listening to The Connection on National Public Radio. My name is Dick Gordon. Elizabeth was just on the phone talking about the recommendations that she's getting to stay with the car that was built in the early 90s because it was built better. Again, it's that same kind of assumption or truism that gets attached to an industry that seems in many ways overloaded with all these notions. Chubba Chet is editor-in-chief of Car and Driver magazine. I guess in part that's what keeps people buying your magazine, that you're not test-driving refrigerators. It's cars, and they have all this other stuff attached to them.
Well, it's certainly an emotional business, and the people who read our magazine, they live and breathe cars. They just want to know everything about them because it's an exciting product. And a lot of people have this sense that cars were built better in the old days, and I must say we don't see much evidence of it. Modern quality errors, mistakes in cars are lower than they've ever been. Modern cars are just as durable as they've ever been. About the only issue I would think about for a really old car is that modern cars have so much more in the way of electronics and various devices on them that as they get older, keeping all those various systems running might be a challenge. But the notion that an engine built in 2000 isn't going to last as long as an engine built in 1992 or 1982, I don't think that's correct at all.
Yeah, but I've been to a wrecking yard and had some guy lean his greasy elbows on the counter and tell me that the straight six will never be beaten. It was an engine that was built, I don't know, 20 years ago, and there's never been anything to equal to it. Is he wrong?
Well, he's working in a wrecking yard. He's not an engineer. I'm not sure I would take that too far.
All right. 1-800-423-8255 to join the connection. We're talking about cars to Charleston, South Carolina. Henry, hello.
Yes, sir.
Hi. Thanks for calling.
Thank you, sir. I have a couple comments. First of all, when the Saturns came out, I was very enthused about this automobile and went out and bought one. Their sales pitch at that time was, we're not going to quibble about the price, and you're going to buy it as it is. But when you go back to resale it, you're going to get a good price. I had one, put 110,000 miles on it. It was over a $14,000 car. It was a brand-new station wagon. Went back to the dealer, and he says, I'll give you $3,000 for this car. It was in immaculate condition. Needless to say, I was very upset about this. Went to the Toyota dealer. Toyota gave me $6,000 because I figured, since high mileage, I'll knock off prices. Since that time in 1996, I have this Toyota. Gets 37 miles to a gallon regularly. I mean, this is not an exception. I've been in the service at once to have the belt changed, and no other service. I do the maintenance, oil changes, and things of this nature. And then my daughter just bought a brand new Xterra last year. Came from the factory, and it inadvertently had the rear oil seal, and the engine went out. Needless to say,
I'm getting confused here, Henry. You're saying you bought a Japanese car and it's working really well, and your daughter bought a Nissan and it's no good.
No, let me finish now. This is what I'm talking about. Let me finish what I'm saying. She bought the car. It inadvertently had something wrong with the engine, lost the oil, and she was out of North Carolina, come down to Charleston on a Sunday, called the Nissan dealer, explained the situation. They were out in 2 hours, picked the car up, took it back to the Nissan dealer. Monday morning, they contacted the Nissan dealer in Asheville. That Nissan dealer then purchased a car off of the Nissan dealer in Charleston. She drove that car back, and they then gave her a car to use until they could order her a brand new car in. There was no question about replacing engines.
Right.
They fell over themselves. I could not believe a service of this nature. I mean, I was absolutely astounded. And I have just had a personal friend that had just bought a brand new Altima. And he had the same situation where the car came in and it had a slight problem, and they repaired it immediately and was falling all over themselves. Now, what I'm saying is you have parity with the quality,
right?
But the customer service is where the bottom line is. When you got to take that car back, like the lady said before, and you got to deal with a dealership that is very reluctant or just actually obstinate in repairing the repairs that are obviously defective.
Let me turn to my panel, because I want to put this to Sean McAlinden on those balancing scales of perception versus reality. Your view?
Well, there's one of the corollaries of something called Akerlof's Lemon Law of Economics is that cars cost too much for the customer to give you a second chance. If we built poor quality in the early 80s or treated the customer badly in the early 90s, we lost millions of customers permanently. And for them, they may have heard that we're doing better now, as Martin knows, but for them to find out may cost them $25,000 or 2 years at $400 a month.
Is there a danger, Sean, that the type of expression that Henry's giving will actually, in fact, make it such that the American car manufacturers have a really hard time making it out of this particular low point in the cycle?
That's particularly the fear for Ford at this time. The dollar losses on the Firestone debacle are about $3.5 billion, and they've lost sales for the last year or so. But their real loss connected to this huge drop in their quality reputation is millions of sales going forward that people might never ever trust Ford in certain cases. For many, many years to come, you can lose an entire generation, as sort of Detroit did in California years ago. And, you know, GM has gotten magnificent quality results. Some of their Buicks match the Toyota Camry. Yet it's still very expensive for the customer to give you a second chance. And that's what's part of that 0.0 finance campaign as well. tell you what, we'll take a, obviously we're going to pay you a, you know, pay you and take a loss to make you try us again. You know, we always have to do that to somehow get a chance back at that brand equity again. And it's going to be a tough road.
Henry, thanks for your call. Our number is 1-800-423-8255. And Leon's calling us from Northampton, New Hampshire. Hi, Leon.
Hi, how are you, Gordon? Thank you for this time.
Yeah, thanks for calling.
I really enjoyed it, that American-made car. This is my fifth of a minivan, and since the 80s, and now I'm driving the 2001. I'm really thinking that we're American. We really should be supporting our own country, our own economy. I really enjoyed American cars. They are making better and improving a lot better than what I drive in the first one.
So you bought one Chrysler, it worked well, you bought another, and you've bought another. It's because the cars have been reliable, though, that you were buying them rather than they were American-made, no?
They are all American-made Chrysler, and this is the fifth one that I bought.
Right. I'm just trying to understand, Leon, that whether or not you're buying them because you like the car or buying them because they're American-made.
One, they're American-made. Second, I think they're just improving so much better from the first one that I drive and to the one I'm driving now. And I think they're just a great car.
All right. Thanks for your call.
Thank you.
John Middlebrook, one on your side.
Well, hey, that was a good endorsement, I guess, for American products. Just to go back on a couple of things, you know, I talk about service from dealerships and lots of independent surveys there. But, again, if you go back to the J.D. Powers or the people that I think are the industry pundits on it, the American-made, if you will, products really do rank up at the top on dealer satisfaction and dealer service. So there's not a discrimination or a difference there. If anything, I would say the advantage goes to the domestic.
And Chubachetta, how far are we away from taking all our old reference points like the Big Three and Motor City and chucking them all in the lake? Because Chrysler's owned by the Germans and the Saturn is owned by GM and Ford is building or owns Volvo, which is challenging American automakers with its new S. I mean, it gets almost too complicated to try and sort out what's what.
It's very complicated. We pick the 10 best cars in America every year in our January issue, and we used to pick 5 domestics and 5 imports, and we gave up on it about 8 years ago because we couldn't tell what was what anymore, and it's just gotten worse since then. But there still is the core of the domestic industry. Ford, at least the domestic side of Ford, is headquartered here in Dearborn in the Detroit area. GM is certainly headquartered here. And even though there's some German management, Chrysler is still basically a domestic company. And there are differences there because even though a lot of the imports are now manufacturing in North America, the lion's share of their engineering and design is still done overseas. And those constructs still are somewhat meaningful, but they're a lot less clear-cut than they used to be, that's for sure.
Our number is 1-800-423-8255 to Lincoln, Massachusetts. Sam, you're on the connection. Hi, Sam.
Yeah, hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Yep.
A comment and a question. The comment first was I heard, I think it was the gentleman from General Motors saying something to the effect that they just build what people want. And I just wanted to take the automobile industry to task a little bit because my perception is that's not true at all, that they spend a huge amount of money on creating what people want. So to say that, well, gee, we're just building what people want, I don't think is doesn't agree with my perception. And my question is, why doesn't the automobile industry take a leadership role in creating transportation modes that are socially responsible instead of just always falling back on the comment that it's...
Give me an example of something specific.
Of something that's socially responsible?
Well, I mean, you want them building trains? It's not going to do their business any good, right? And so what do you mean?
No, I mean, I guess I'm just wondering what business they're in. I mean,
my guess is
business of making money.
Yeah.
And as opposed to providing transportation. So if they are in the automobile industry, I guess that's independent transportation vehicles, why don't they take a leadership role in creating vehicles that are socially responsible? By that I mean that don't pollute the environment, don't cause excessive accidents, You know, I had to buy a bigger car mostly because I'm scared to death of all these SUVs on the road. They're just, if you hit one of those things, you're a goner. And I think the automobile industry is responsible for creating that desire.
Well, let's let John Middlebrook in. I mean, what
my
business?
My question is, why don't they take a leadership role in creating the desire for socially responsible modes of transportation?
He heard you.
Well, that's a great question, and we're going to continue to work on that. We just introduced our latest fuel cell product here at the auto show, which we think can come within by the end of the decade. But I mean, we have created products to try to see if there was a pull from the marketplace. Our electric vehicle is a great example of that. And absolutely, after we took care of a few hundred environmentalists, nobody else was stepping up to buy them. And that's a case where, again, the freedom that the automobile gives people is what they're after. We do try to give people what they want. If we don't, we go out of business. So we don't have any choice but to meet customer demand.
But go ahead, Chava.
Yeah, there's this sense sometimes that the industry, through its advertising budget, can make the buyers behave like lemmings and purchase whatever they want. And all I would say is, if we look at history over the last 25 years, GM's market share was, I believe, 48% back in the mid-70s, and it's now 28 or 29%. I would submit that if GM had the ability through its advertising to make people buy whatever it told them to buy, it might have suggested they keep buying GM cars and not lose that large portion of their market share.
Sean McElinden, is there in any sense a role for government here the way there once was in the past?
Look, our gasoline is selling nationwide now at $1.20 a gallon. The rest of the world's paying from $4.50 to $5. You know, that's a 500% difference. Detroit is and Tokyo are a collection of private sector firms that have to react to that market. And you just can't mandate products that people don't want for that side of their conscience that says they have to do something about the environment and expect it to work. Somebody's got to take some leadership in Washington, and hopefully with a business case in mind and the economic ramifications involved in that, in order for us to make progress on that issue. You know, GM spent $600 million on that electric vehicle, put it on the curb in California, and didn't get anything back. And they're going to do it again with this fuel cell. And that's Toyota and Honda with their hybrids are doing the same thing. But at some point, if we want to alleviate social costs, thereby produce social benefits, government has to play a role, and probably the major leadership role in this, and hopefully in a way that allows this largest of all American industries, to move forward into the future doing what they're doing, which is moving people around this big country.
John Middlebrook, in 10 seconds or less, who drives who out of the recession? The car makers driving the economy, or the economy helping the car makers out?
Well, both have to help one another. We think we've done quite a bit to keep the economy in the dip, maybe softened with the 0% financing and the industry lift that we got in the fourth quarter. But the bets are off in the first quarter. We do see some softening, and we really need the rest of the market to help pull us up.
Thanks to all of you. John Middlebrook, Vice President of Vehicle Brand Marketing and Corporate Advertising for GM. Chava Chetta is Editor-in-Chief of Car and Driver Magazine. Sean McElinden, Director of the Economics and Business Group at the Center for Automotive Research, CAR. Our senior producer is Graham Smith. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection.